podde tillbaks igen. Linus på baslinjen. Ja, han är tillbaka igen. Linus på baslinjen.
Welcome to this special episode recorded on the road. This was a live interview in front of a couple of younger tennis juniors, 12 and 14 years old, that was able to ask some questions in the end to this episode's guest, Milo Bradley. He works as the Tennis Australia National Development Squad Coach in the Australian Capital Territory, and have previously worked together with players such as Casey De La Cura, I don't know about the pronunciation, Matt Ebden, Kokkinakis, John Millman, Storm Sanders, to name a few. In this chat, or in this interview, we talk about if Milo think he can spot talent, why to not have a coach might have been Kyrgios' best decision in regard to become a pro. We talk about if Kyrgios, Kokkinakis and more are good role models for the Australian players. Australia's position on the globe and how it affects the tournament planning for juniors, and what the most important part is for 12-year-old players to learn. Hope you enjoy this chat. Please welcome Milo Bradley. All right, Milo, Dave introduced you here before, but I'm thinking it would be great if we can start with a short introduction of yourself and what your role at the Australian Federation is at the moment.
Yep, my story at the Australian Tennis Federation, I've been there for 25 years in a variety of ways in different areas. My current role is taking specifically care of the Australian Capital Territory, which sits in the nation's capital there. It's a small area just outside of Sydney, but my influence moves far and wide within the Australian Tennis Federation for what I've been doing since about 96 or 97. A lot of it has been done at the level of basically working with younger kids between now 12-year-olds all the way up to 24-year-olds in a variety of roles that have went from what they call a state coach, which was head of a provincial area, or a national academy coach, or for a little while I was involved with the Australian Institute of Sport, and then on with the Junior Davis Cup squad. A lot of my players have come from a large variety of areas. If you think about Western Australia, it's a massive state. You can fit Texas and Alaska inside Western Australia. One of my players had traveled to come to training 2 days a week, had traveled a minimum of 2.5 hours just to get there for training, and lived in a town of 448 people. That was just in one area. But as you go along the way, I've lived in another part of Australia, in South Australia, where I took care of today, if you've heard of Tanasi Kokkinakis and Luke Saville, and you've got a large group of people there that were at the top of the game that won Junior Davis Cup in the development and did a lot of different things in there. Whereas I'm at now in Canberra, where I've chose to go there so I could do many of other things. We do have Nick Kyrgios there, but Nick was there when I was running through with the AIS when he was about 14, 15 years old, around training. My role does a lot of variety of things. This stage of the journey where you've caught me, I'm on tour with a group of 12-year-olds. The 12-year-olds are our nation's best 12-year-olds. It's anticipated that we'd hope if they behave, if they do all the right things and they compete hard, not necessarily get the results, but if they compete hard and do well, they'll stay ahead of their crop and they'll probably represent us next year in World Youth Cup, we hope. Yeah. We got two girls, two boys in this crop. We got another crop coming in to Kufstein. They're a little bit below that group in that particular area.
Yeah. You named a few players there that is coming from Australia that have made it to the pro circuit.
Is it, can you see early who's gonna make it as a pro or not? How do you, can you see talent or in what age?
It's difficult to say you can see talent. I know in Western Australia, I mentioned the size of the state on purpose because I ran the biggest talent search in the whole nation and ran 16 weeks of it. And I identified Australian football players more so, and I identified cricketers. Tennis is a tough sport to get into. It's a rich man's sport to a great degree, and you have to work hard to get into it. So I see lots of talent. It's whether the real thing is whether they actually enjoy tennis in that scheme of things. And so usually a lot of the players that I take on are people that, one, work hard, extremely hard. They have a strong work ethic because I believe a strong work ethic eliminates fear. Also, you know, the ones that not only work hard, but they enjoy the sport. They have multiple goals. It's not just, hey, I want to make it to the top 100, even though that's our eventual goal. Because I don't believe you can't get to the top 100 unless you enjoy it. It's a lonely man sport. It's a very tough sport to be involved in. In fact, you guys here have chosen probably the hardest sport in the world. I mean, I grew up as a young kid playing ice hockey. And I did very well in America in ice hockey in Canada and in the States. But that was a lot easier than tennis. Tennis is a pretty tough sport.
You named the work ethic as one of the maybe most important attributes, is that how you say? From the outside, it would be easy to say that maybe Kyrgios and Kokkinakis and those guys, Tomic, maybe were more of talented players. But have they worked super hard as well, would you say?
What people don't understand about Nick is, since we go to the top of the tree and everybody knows about him and he doesn't have a coach and all the other stuff, I don't think everybody sees Nick in his true sense. You see what social media shows you. You see a lot of different things. But the Nick I know in the hour and 30 minutes that he spends on court, it's an hour and 30 minutes of not messing around. If he's out there for an hour, it's an hour. It's a complete 60 minutes of let's get on with it and let's do it properly. I mean, I grew up and I once did 30 minutes with Jimmy Connors, and I learned pretty quick in 25 minutes. I was absolutely stuffed because I actually, you know, and that's all he trained that day was that 30 minutes. And Nick's that sort of person. Nick is growing up and he's matured a lot. A lot of people don't see that. People don't see the fact that the type of stuff that he does in the gym or the physio, you know, and all of our stats that we've had in Australia, Nick never appeared on the charts. Nick was never the best at the you know, the 5 meter sprint. He was never the best at the vertical jump. He was never the best in the actual beep test or the yo-yo test or all those things. Nick, though, he actually loved the game and he got in and had a crack at it. There's a lot of reasons why he doesn't appear to look like he is, but trust me, he, for the time he puts out there, fine. Kokkinakis, I mean, he actually has a huge, he had a huge workload as a kid. He would finish his squads before I got to him, and he'd do maybe 2 hours a day, and then his private coach would take him out and do another hour and a half on top of it. So, but that possibly could have caused some of his injury woes, because he was on the court a fair bit, but he wasn't exactly the best in town at that stage in the physical department. Which now, you know, he's learned from all that. So he's had two stress fractures of the back, and Kokkinakis has. He's had lots of other injuries that's done him wrong and some silly playing around. So he's learned from all that. So some of these guys, they might appear to be, you could identify them as talented, yes. But on the other side, that these guys have, you know, strong work ethics that we don't see.
In Sweden, we talk about a lot about the importance of role models to look up to. Do you, in Tennis Australia, think they are good role models for the youngsters?
I guess it depends on how you define a role model in a great degree, because what people don't see in Nick Kyrgios in the local community is he runs the Nick Kyrgios Foundation. And anytime I ask Nick to do something, Nick doesn't. Never says no.
Okay.
Nick shows up at young events for charity, and he gives of his time nonstop. If you look up online, NK Foundation, he's trying to build a place down in Melbourne for the unfortunate kids in certain areas. His money's there. So there's, if you want a role model, I'm sorry. he's not on the court all the time. You know, he fights his, he says his thing. Yeah. But Nick does a lot of things that people just don't see.
I understand.
You know, it's how people live in life and they don't want to give away what they do, but he does that well.
Yeah.
You know, the Kakanakis, these boys, and anybody that's been through a lot of these areas in the Davis Cup and stuff in our culture, if I said, and if they said to you, said, oh, what are you doing this for? And, you know, they said, well, Milo asked me to. That's because it started when they were young and they realized the responsibilities of being in teams events. They realized the responsibility of compete and to respect their opponents. As you're growing up, you don't always get it right. And it takes, as a young man, to kind of put it all together. And it takes quite a while, even into your 30s. And these boys are coming together. So, and they do a lot of things that out there when they're asked to. And a lot of the younger kids see it, and they don't knock a hit back when they're asked to. Like in my neighborhood, I got Charlie Camus there under Nick. You know, he's 48 in the world in the ITF juniors, and he's only 16 turning 17. And when Nick needs a hit, you know, wherever Nick is, Charlie jumps up, he's there. So, you know.
I understand. It's give and take, yeah. When you work with the, you're here with the national teams, for example, at this tournament. How do you guys pick the players for the national teams?
These kids are picked upon their ranking and the results and their behavior and their ability to compete. Kids that get in trouble and stuff in their younger ages probably won't get picked right away. We've had some kids that actually do get picked and misbehave on tours, and we have to send them home. And they don't get picked on the next tour that they go around. But this is with the 12-year-olds, this is their first main tour into Europe, and their first opportunity to learn their areas. And, you know, Australia thinks that they're quite meaningful, so that's why they've sent me on this one with these kids to actually see if they can put things together.
If they get selected to these groups of players, how much help do they get from the federation?
They're already getting help from the federation with their training in a lot of ways, because it's called their National Development Squad's support program that we run, which they get things back home. Coming here, they don't get everything paid for. Everybody is an obligation to pay something. It's not for free. We've always done that because we don't think everybody's entitled to actually get whatever they want. So they do pay a certain percentage that their parents pay, but they do have a predominantly a lot of it that gets subsidized by the Australian Federation.
Okay.
On average, to be honest with you, they're probably paying about a minimum of 55 to 75 Aussie a day for being out here. And when you do that up over a month, for them, I mean, that's what they're paying, even though it costs us money to support them.
Okay.
The fact that they've got coaches here is a massive support.
Of course, yeah.
A massive support.
Australia is geographically a bit far away from the rest of the world, sort of. How does that affect the tournament scheduling and stuff like that?
Yeah, we are, everybody uses that as, you know, within my culture, no excuses, but I mean, there's always a big thing about Australia being so far away, and
but it is, I guess.
It is. I mean, I guess if you get on the global app and you guess a place, I mean, it is about, you know, a good 5,000 Ks away. But I'll be honest with you, it's when you get older, it's really tough, because when you get older, you got to stay away from home longer in the beginning. A good solid 9 months, depending what you're ranked at. You know, if you're ranked in the low 1,000s in the ATP, you're going to have to do some time out here. In the junior years, we've done a lot of studies on it. We believe that we're better off spending our money sending 12-year-olds over for three and a half weeks, and then taking them home, let them settle again, and then sending them out for another three and a half weeks again into a different part of the journey over here in Europe, because it's such a far way to go. Our theory in doing that is basically that 3 weeks is about the breaking mark. There's a, you know, land, there's acquaintance, get together, romance, and then, you know, everybody falls apart at 12.
Mm. But 3 weeks they can manage.
We manage 3 weeks. Okay. The older ones, like the other group, the 14-year-olds, they're here about 4.5, 5 weeks. Our ones that are a higher level, our Grand Slam players, they've been out here a long time. For example, I had a boy that just finished in the doubles at Junior Wimbledon. They got on a flight this morning at Gatwick, and they're flying home, but he'll be home for 2 weeks, and he'll do some stuff locally, and then he'll go again.
Okay.
So, and then our next port of call is Asia, because it's close. For us, really, Asia is probably the best place for us to go compete, even though for the younger people, it's important for us to come over here for Europe so we can figure out how to compete.
Okay, because Europe is tougher?
You have clay. Where we're at in Canberra, we've got the biggest amount of clay courts in the country, basically, of European clay. So we're an advantage there. But this time of year, it's -7 degrees. And we've got 4 indoor courts. And that's all we got. And we've got to fight over that. And it's very cold, and the balls don't bounce. And, you know, we're out there pouring locks, pouring hot water on locks to open up sheds and taking our balls and moving around. Like, you guys hit indoors all the time, you're used to it. Well, like, I have a rule that you hit outside till it's 5 degrees, because wherever you are in the country, you know, there's not a lot of indoor courts in Australia, because in the summertime it gets warm. So we're the only place in Australia that has a good center that has that situation.
Wow.
So the rule is, you know, because somewhere else, if you're in South Australia and it's 5 degrees, well, that's going to be their coldest day, and they're hitting. so there's no reason why we should be indoors.
Yeah, I see.
So, and plus we're at 550 meters, so we were actually close to altitude, and so the ball flies a little bit.
Yeah.
So in the wintertime when it's freezing cold, yeah, it's no fun. That's so for us, for the camp where I'm at now, it's getting kids, like I have a lot of other kids in the programs that are not in the national program, that are over in Spain right now, they're over in another part of Europe. I got some in Serbia and some in Croatia. So getting them out, in the wintertime. There's only one part of Australia that it's good for the wintertime, and that's in Queensland.
Okay. When you're here with under 12 players, for example, what do you focus on during a tour like this to teach them and work with?
My big thing, for example, tomorrow's travel day, and my big thing tomorrow is most of these kids have their parents do everything for them, and in the past, you know, like mom and dad would pack their bags for them, mom and dad would get them in the car for them, mom and dad pick them up and put them here. And one of my key specialities within the core group in Australia is to teach independence, particularly amongst young men. It's important to be independent, and it's important to gain those skills, because when you're on the court, you become stronger and more self-confident. So tomorrow's travel day for us. For example, when I come out of here, I'll go into a meeting, and my first job is to educate them that under no uncertain terms, do not miss the departure time at 11:15 a.m. because we have to walk 300 meters to get a bus, maybe 700 meters to get a bus with our bags. I purposely not taking a taxi, because it's only 300 meters.
Of course.
Yeah, I mean, 700 meters is pretty easy. So we push our bags down and go. When you go with Milo, you know, on this trip, it's a bus, train, and a walk. Sometimes, though, if you misbehave, it can turn into maybe what we call a foot falcon. Now, a foot falcon is pretty simple. I mean, a foot falcon in Australia is, it used to be a Ford Falcon that you drive, but if you're walking, we call it a foot falcon. In other words, if you mess around, you're probably going to be doing a lot more walking than actually riding. And since I got a lot of work to do administrative tomorrow, the kids aren't going to want to do all that stuff. So they're getting extra time tonight to play around. You know, right? They get their phones back. Normally I take their phones away from them. So they get their phones back, so most likely they'll be naughty. They'll have to behave, because most of them are next door to me, and I like to sleep. So the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, when they get up in the morning, the boys have to actually go hit, because they didn't hit today. All right, they had a day off. They're spoiled. then they've got to get back here and get showered because I don't like stinky young men. You know what I mean? Because I had daughters, and I'm not going to introduce stinky young men to my daughters. That's how I've always been. Just ask my son-in-law. You know, he's pretty much like that. So what I'm getting at here is that it's about skills. Having your skills ready. Do you get your passport ready? They're not going to have to use it here. But have you paid all your accounts? Like, purpose, they've put things in their bills for their rooms. So have you gone and paid that? Have you got your receipts? Have you made sure all those things are there? The girls got their morning off because they're playing today. So they've got some jobs they have to do, like they have to pick up their rackets to make sure they have the rackets in the bag. And if they can't pick it up on time, it's not ready, they need to arrange for the other crew to pick it up for them. In other words, there's a few things that normally their parents would do that they need to get done tomorrow. Now, it's a very small amount. I've had crews in the past that would I'd load them down with lots of things. For example, if they give me any trouble, like my boys are up on the second floor, I'd take their gear and toss them off the second floor. Then, well, you know, they got to start all over again. So it's a training skill to know that how you got to have things packed. They've already had two room checks this week. You know, they've got to get to meetings on time. And these are important to me because I have had players at a professional level. We're at Eastbourne once where I've had a player and I asked him three times, what time's your next match? He said, I don't have a match today. So I drove all the way back to Wimbledon for some other duties, got back there my thing, and I got a message from Sam Groth saying, listen, they need so-and-so here because he's got to play. And I looked at so-and-so and I said, what do you mean? You're 19 years old. There's no way I can get back from Wimbledon to Eastbourne. No. So these skills, gentlemen, are pretty important to develop automatically.
And when you're home then, practicing like during a training block or whatever, what do you think is important to work on when you're in this age, around between 12 and 14? What skills do you as a coach want to put in place?
Yeah, I have a big philosophy in my area that we're highly connecting with the private coach so that I know what the private coach is working on, ground strokes or whatever. I provide a certain amount of volume, which we base upon the fact of 30 balls in 60 seconds. Now, if you multiply that out over an hour, you probably get somewhere, if you do 30 balls in Milo's mass, 30 balls in 60 seconds over 60 seconds, you're probably going to have somewhere around 1,800. If you do that in 2 hours, multiply it over 5 days, you're probably close to 10,000 balls. So if you're in there, there's a certain amount of volume we've got to hit, number one. From the ground stroking point of view, volley smashes and everything. There's a certain amount of serves we've got to hit. So I spent a lot of time working on trying to, with the young ones, 12 years old, hitting between 50 to 70 serves a day, putting that into their whole structure. Working on so many completions and returns, working on so many first balls. We put lots of rules in. For example, in our crew, in our culture, we no double faults into the net, no returns into the net, otherwise we play the point over again. Okay. First ball has to go over the net. That's mandatory. Because the pros are literally 99%. We're big believers that if you miss the coach's feed, well, you actually, it's the grim to the grim of death. Let a ball bounce twice. And of course, one of the things we hate the most is having to come over here and hit short with you guys, because I'm always bantering with guys that, you know, hitting short is a nightmare, because we don't play short when we play a match. So that's in a regular day occasion. We have different themes and different days. I spend a lot of times with people because the private coaches don't have time to work on volleys and smashes. We're probably now, even though we used to lead the world in this area, we're probably the worst in volleys and smashes and completions, particularly. we go around, and for example, if you ask yourself, how many smashes do you have in a warm-up? Most of you would probably say, I don't know. I could actually go to a nationals and see in the warm-up that the most average person would, in the guys, would probably hit around 6 to 8 smashes if you're lucky. Girls wouldn't hit a dry volley, even though they hit 90% dry volleys in the match. So what I'm trying to get at is that I try to put all these things in place. And when I'm working with players individually and stuff like that, I go to the skills that their coach doesn't work on. So when I first got to where I was at there, we had probably the most dismal volleys in the world. So I spent all my time just working on volleys.
Okay.
You know, if you got a wall, volley is one of the most simplest things in tennis.
Okay.
Absolutely most simplest things in tennis. If you look at what Newton's laws of physics are, all you got to do is put a wall up and the ball's going to rebound where you want it to go. So those things, the smash, it's simple to the serve. Yeah. So, and then the other thing is that the law started doubles. Doubles, I got Matt Ebden, who I brought forth. He's about to crack top 110 in doubles. And Matty, when he was young, he was in the final crew at the Coca-Cola Masters with Nadal and a few of the other guys that were there, Kevin Peterson and stuff, Kevin Anderson, sorry. And, you know, he got beat 6-1 by Nadal at the age of 14. But in time, in fact, he quit tennis and played a few other sports and didn't come back till he was 18. But Matty, great skills in doubles. Comes out of a South African background, stuff like that. But if you went and watched him now, he's so analytical about his doubles. And when we spend our time working on doubles with young kids, it's just positioning where you need to be, how you got to go about things, divide the angles, and go from there. So we do spend a lot of time. Like, for example, my boys won doubles last week in the tournament we were in, and they were down about losing the singles, but as soon as we said, we got doubles, let's get into it. All right, so we get out there early in the morning, we're up, you know, ready to go at 6 o'clock, and we changed our skills around, and we just went solely on doubles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and working on our communication, working on our teamwork, working on the whole concept of how we use our volley and how we try to stay away from becoming just cross-court ralliers.
Okay. So you think the volley game in doubles is, how do you say, transfer? You can transfer that to the singles game
absolutely,
as well?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, in the singles game, you're, in essence, one thing, if you look at the stats, the Spanish have their success rate, their volleys are literally 100%.
Yeah.
You ever see a Spanish guy ever miss a ball in volleying? Mm. Well, it's not because he's practicing it all day, but he sets up his shots well enough where he comes in and all he's got to do is put the ball away.
Mm.
So, you know, and I spent a bit of time there in Spain with my other guys, and, you know, we've got a couple of the Spanish guys I've been with before, and, you know, the volley is treated as God because it's how they win points. So.
I see. You mentioned that one of the reasons you travel to Europe is because we have clay courts. Do you think that's a big negative for Australia? You don't have that many clay courts?
Yeah, we don't have the... Listen, Australia, clay courts here in this part of the world is part of your culture. You know, you go to a club and it gets passed on from family to family, how the groundsman takes care of things and how things are done. In Australia, we're a grass court nation and a dirt nation. And our climate isn't conducive to the same type of clay.
Okay.
So, and we've tried hard. I mean, I can honestly say within the Federation, I've been unsuccessful with 28 clay courts. That's a lot of money gone.
Yeah.
And you need, whereas we're at now, I don't know how it'll be, but as long as we have that groundsman there who treats it as if it's his own massive job and he gets paid well enough. But I don't think there's many groundsmen over here in Europe that get paid like this guy does. So, or get supported, and we import our clay from Italy.
Uh-huh.
So what I'm saying there is, like, I mean, I've been all over Europe, and we've got a variety of stuff. I got stuff in South Australia that I take that it's not the same. The Swiss clay we had imported to one part of Victoria, and it went bad, really bad. You just wouldn't touch it, and I got some similar clay in South Australia, but it's been able to hold good.
So you have tried.
So we've tried. So, yeah. But there's one thing we're missing. We can import all the clay in the world, but there's one thing we're missing. It's Europeans. Mm. Europeans play distinctively different than Australians.
Okay, yeah.
So in defense of us, you know, how we get by in those areas is a variety of tactics, but the reality is, Europeans got our measure there. And we have to work hard with it, and that's why we come, so we can learn.
I see. Last question, Milo. Before we started, we chatted a little bit about creating cultures before. What is a great culture for you when we talk about player development?
Yeah, a great culture is, for example, I purely believe a program is just a marketing tool to a strategy that you're trying to achieve something. I've been highly successful at creating environments of which coaches and players get together and they can do things and they successfully achieve things. Mm. Creating a culture is one where you match your basically your vision and your basically goals and objectives where you want to go, but where everybody's working together and having a good time. For example, in what we're trying to create where I'm at now is getting people to take responsibility for each other, being willing to hit with each other, whether it's male or female, or being adaptable to hitting up or down, and giving us the greatest joy of playing the sport. Some people go through the phase where they become, it's all about me, myself, and I, and that's the only team. Whereas, I don't know if any of you've watched that that Apple TV program, Ted Lasso. If you get a chance, watch it. He goes through quite a few episodes, but he's quite of a funny character. He's an American that goes over to England that takes over an English Premier League team, Richmond. And in it, he knows nothing about football, but he knows everything about people.
Okay.
Never tells you that. He's a bit of a Muppet. And he's kind of funny. So you get a lot of laughs and jokes out of it. They got subtitles, so you can actually, you know, you get it. But the thing is, in it, it gets down to this concept of belief. And all the guys in the team, it's kind of like I tell my guys, I says, we're just the island of misfit toys. None of us actually fit into any structure. But if we can get out there and have a good time while we're doing it, work hard, we might find that we might actually do something. And in Ted Lasso's thing, he talks about this thing where he has this dream about where he changes the format of the team, where if one player goes up to attack in football, another player moves in behind him and backs him up. And then when this guy who's attacking, if he doesn't have a shot, he passes the ball off to another guy. Doesn't matter that this is the star player, but he passes it off to this other guy where he gets the ball. And if he doesn't have a shot, he might pass it back, but he shoots it over and hits it to somewhere else. It's exactly what the Dutch have been doing for years. In other words, it's in our culture is trying to get people to know that, hey, if I need someone down to hit with you at 6 o'clock in the morning, I got an 18-year-old that says, yeah, I'll be there, Mala. And I got people now like that starting to happen. I got people that say, oh, over here, oh, Milo, I know you're busy. You got something happening between 4 and 6. Do you need backup?
Okay.
You get what I'm saying? And, you know, people say, oh, I know you're busy here. Don't worry. If you made that error, that's fine. I'll get back to you on that. We'll have our meeting another day. Do you want me to go hit with so-and-so? So-and-so's got to go away to our team's event. Do you want me to? And this is what these guys starts happening. And in a culture, it's not just hitting together. It's also like we'd go out and we'd have a meal night. You know, like you guys get together around Dave when you're out here, where you eat together and you do things together. Because when the tennis is done and you go back to your club, then it's you guys together. You're not out competing like when you're young. And so you got to give back to the sport. And that's the kind of culture that really in Australia is we're working hard to, in some parts, maintain, some parts improve, and some parts take it to another level.
I see. Super. Milo, thank you very much. Guys, do we have any additional question maybe? Yeah?
I'm late.
Oh, you're late?
Okay. Someone else, maybe?
We have about 3 minutes.
Yeah, okay.
What is the key, what is the key to developing in our age?
Sorry?
What is the key to developing in our age?
What do you think is the most important things to develop right now at 12s, 14s?
Yep. On the court?
Yeah.
On the court, you serve and return. Two most important things in the game.
Yep. Serve and return. Every practice, huh?
Every practice should include serve and return.
What I really liked is that, you know, these guys don't understand the urgency, and I get on them all the time about get another ball in play. You miss the ball, that's okay, but don't walk in the emote, you get another ball in play. Contacts with the balls. I loved what you said about that. Do you understand why now, boys?
Yeah,
it's about getting contacts with the ball. Everybody's going to miss. It's about contacting the ball, trying to get it done, and if you miss, run and get it, get back, breathe out, and then start again. Good question. Anything else? One question more? Two questions?
Yeah, go ahead. One more.
Okay. What did, for example, Nick Kyrgios do that other players didn't do to become pro?
To become pro, I think he made a decision to not have a coach. I think in all fairness to Nick, if you know his journey, I mean, it's a pretty big decision. He's had lots of guidance and a lot of things in there, and you know, people question all that and say, "Oh, what does he know?" But at a young age, it's pretty bold to actually say that. This is why he talks. Trust me, he talks to a lot of people, but which means with no coach, he's got to actually get together with his manager, his physiotherapist who takes care of him. I'm a complete outsider, but he's got to organize his life. And so the more you become responsible for that and accountable for that, then you become truly independent.
That's good. Any other questions? Last chance, because Milo has other things to do.
Oh, I had the same as you.
You had the same?
Okay, no, you're okay, guys. You got anything else? Guys have done well. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed this little extra episode, and I'm pretty sure I could have chatted for another hour with Milo Bradley and covered a lot of more subjects. Maybe we will have the opportunity in the future again. And for you listeners that are maybe from outside of Sweden, you can look in the library where you can find probably 40 or 50 other episodes in English. So please head back and listen to them as well. And another episode in Swedish is coming in a couple of days. So stay tuned. Thank you very much. But before we wrap this episode up, I would like to announce that Euroelite Germany is now officially a new partner to this podcast. Euroelite Germany is run by the Swedish coach Mikael Andreasson, that have also been a guest in this podcast. And it's based in Peding on the border between Germany and Austria. A big welcome to Euroelite Germany. I have been to the academy over there, and I can tell everybody that it's a super nice facility and with a great view of the mountains. I can highly recommend you guys to make a visit there. Thanks, Euroelite Germany, for your support. This episode is also sponsored by MajorCamp. Go to majorcamp.com and read more about how you can make your visit to Spain and Mallorca to the best experience ever. They make paddle and tennis camps both for groups, bigger groups, or for smaller groups. And they can organize it exactly like you want. Thank you, MajorCamp.